I really like it when you get the present in advance. You're really, it's like eating dessert first. It's very good. Well, after that wonderful introduction, I really can hardly wait to hear myself. And so I thought I'd better get going. What I'm going to talk about tonight is an idea that Albert Einstein had in order to use his new theory of general relativity and to apply it to the universe. What Einstein did back in 1917 was to use the astronomical information of the day, which was that we lived in a system of stars which appeared to be static, and to make his theory work with the observations that people saw, he needed to put something extra in, and he did. He put in something called the cosmological constant, which I'll talk about tonight. It's a kind of anti-gravity force. It pushes back against the force of things clumping together. And it was something which made a static universe. But within 10 years, observations showed that the universe was not static, that the system of stars that Einstein had paid attention to was really too nearby a thing to represent the whole universe, and that we live in a universe that is expanding. The legend is that Einstein then said that the cosmological constant was his greatest blunder, and we will examine this historical conundrum in great detail. Well, not in very great detail. But what's so interesting about this is that in recent years, in the last 10 years, as David said, observations have pushed us again to a surprising new understanding of what the universe is doing by using supernovae, which are exploding stars. Here's one exploding star in a system of 100 billion stars, a galaxy. And for a little while, about a month, a supernova is as bright as several billion stars like the Sun. That means we can see them to great distances, and it turns out these thermonuclear supernovae, these type 1 supernovae, have the remarkable property that they're very similar from one to another in their brightness, and the differences in brightness that they have can actually be understood by observations, so that we can use them as very reliable distance measuring tools in the universe. We've been able to use this and to plot out the history of cosmic expansion over a very big span of space and time, and we see that the universe is speeding up over time. So it's not only expanding, but expanding faster over time, accelerating. And one of the ideas of what we need is some constituent of the universe which is like the cosmological constant, something which has this sort of anti-gravity pushing things apart kind of quality. And so that's why I've called this talk Einstein's Blunder Undone. Now, I have about 13.7 billion years worth of cosmic history, and I want to cover it in 42 minutes. So I'm going to leave out some details. Here's where we live. We live, the Sun is a star in the Milky Way galaxy. You can see it on the summer sky here in Santa Barbara. In 1917, people thought that the Milky Way galaxy, the system of stars that the Sun belongs to, was the universe. Today, we know that our galaxy is just one of 100 billion galaxies of more or less equivalent brightness. So our galaxy is a big flat galaxy. I'll show you pictures of others that show it's probably a spiral like they are. And it has some little neighbors over here, the clouds of Magellan, which figure in our story a little bit. So here's Einstein at about the time of interest. Now, one important idea in this talk is that the development of the human mind has not actually been so good since 1917, but the development of technology has been excellent, and the instruments that astronomers have to make measurements have gotten much better. And this is illustrated a little bit here by the fact that this is a photograph of Einstein taken with photographic film. Today, we would use a digital camera in which the light would go onto a silicon surface and make electrons. In the old days, it made a chemical kind of reaction that people used to make photographs like this one. And it meant that the exposure had to be quite long. So, for example, you can see that this guy actually disagreed with what Einstein was saying, and this person left the room. What has happened since then is that technology has developed quite a bit, and we're actually able to see what Einstein was thinking. And apparently, what Einstein was thinking at that time was that the universe must be static, because when he said universe, they meant the Milky Way galaxy, and it is not expanding or contracting. The stars, the motions of the stars, are not systematic in that way. But it was a question of sort of looking too nearby. Here's what Einstein did to take into account the fact that the universe was the Milky Way galaxy. Can you see that from the very back? Oh, too bad, because I was going to say it was in German. Anyway, it says here, that term, the cosmological term, is necessary only for the purpose of making possible a quasi-static distribution of matter, something that wasn't expanding or contracting, as required by the fact of the small velocities of the stars. So many times people say, well, Einstein, quite a dreamer, had kind of philosophical views. Well, I guess those things are true, but in this case, the argument that he advanced was the data about stars, that the reason for putting in the cosmological constant was that the stars didn't have large motions. Now, how did this picture change? Well, one of the ways the picture changed was by the work of these women at the observatory at Harvard. Why were there so many women given the opportunity to work for very low wages at Harvard? The answer is given by the observatory director. He said, a great observatory should be as carefully organized and administered as a railroad. You following this, David? A great savings may be effectuated by employing unskilled and therefore inexpensive labor, of course, under careful supervision. The actual occasion was that the observatory director was very dissatisfied with his assistant, a young man, and he said, my housekeeper could do a better job. And he hired his housekeeper to run this group of women who did a lot of the observational work at the observatory. And one of these women, Henrietta Swan Leavitt, was given the job of studying variable stars, stars that get brighter and dimmer over time. And she found out something extremely important, which opened up the picture of what the universe was from this small picture of the Milky Way galaxy to the big picture we have today, a system of 100 billion galaxies flying apart, which are equivalent to the Milky Way. So how did she do that? Well, here's a picture of Henrietta Leavitt from George Johnson's book. George Johnson was a writer in residence here at the KITP last fall. She studied in stars, these variable stars, and she found that there was a relation between the way they vibrated and how bright they really were. By looking at a collection of stars in the Magellanic Clouds that I mentioned earlier, satellite of the Milky Way galaxy, that were all at the same distance, she could tell which were really bright and which were really dim. And as she said, it is worthy of notice that the brighter variables have the longer periods. This means you can tell from looking at one of those stars whether it's a 200-watt bulb or a 100-watt bulb or a 50-watt bulb. Astronomers are often in the position of looking out at night and trying to figure out how far away the sources are. It's like going out at night over a desert highway, and you look out and you could try to guess whether things are nearby or far away by the brightness, the apparent brightness of the lights. But you could make a mistake if the lights were of different brightness and you couldn't recognize them. In this case, what Henrietta Leavitt did was discover a way to know whether you were looking at an extra bright or an extra dim star, and by making that correction, you were able to make very good estimates of distances. The stars that she worked on, the Cepheid variable stars, are quite luminous, and they can be seen in other nebulae, other galaxies, with the instruments that were under construction at about the time she was working. And this is a picture of the great telescope of its time, the 100-inch, that means the diameter of the mirror. An inch is a unit used here in the United States and in Myanmar. That is 2.5 meters to you. That's the size of the mirror. And this was at Mount Wilson, up above Pasadena, which at that time was a sleepy little city of 25,000. It was very dark at night as they looked out over the Los Angeles basin. And this telescope was used by Edwin Hubble. Here he is using a photographic plate. That's what goes in this gadget right here, and he has a couple of wheels in his hand to adjust the telescope as it moves across the sky, taking pictures of nearby nebulae, these fuzzy clouds, looking for individual stars in them that could be connected by Miss Leavitt's relation, so that you could tell how bright the stars really were and how far away those fuzzy things were. Well, what Hubble showed was that the Milky Way is not the whole universe, that we live in a universe made up of other galaxies whose distances from us are very large compared to the distances inside the Milky Way. When you go out tonight after the talk, if it's clear, you can look out and you can see stars whose light has been traveling to us for several hundred years. So the speed of light is a foot, as I described earlier, a unit of distance used locally, a foot in a nanosecond, in a billionth of a second. So that means that you never see the world the way it really is. You always see the world the way it was. So people up in the front, I see the way they were a few nanoseconds ago. The light bounces off them and comes toward me. These are the reserved seats, and the people in the back appear younger. That's because the light has been traveling for a long time to get here. So the people in the back, I see the way they were 40 nanoseconds ago. Well, okay, it's just a joke in the room. But when you go outside, it's not a joke that the stars that you see nearby, you see as they were 40 years ago, or 100 years ago, or a few hundred years ago. When you see galaxies, it turns out you are looking back distances that are 1,000 times bigger. Typically, a few million light years is the distance to even the nearest galaxy. So what this did was open up the scale of the universe by a factor of 1,000. What I'm going to talk about toward the end of the talk are galaxies whose distance is a few billion light years away, another factor of 1,000. And to do that, turns out we need much brighter objects than the ones that Henrietta Leavitt was studying. And those will turn out to be the supernovae. Okay, so here's the picture. The Milky Way is not unique, but there is a universe made up of billions of galaxies, about 100 billion galaxies within the piece of the universe that we can see. Our own galaxy is just one of those, and our own location is just a particular place on a star in the outskirts of a big spiral galaxy, the thing we call the Milky Way. Okay, if Hubble had only done that, it would have been enough. But he also did something else, which was very interesting. He had distances to a number of these nebulae based on the apparent brightness of stars. And it turns out people had also been measuring the light from supernovae, from something, from galaxies, and spreading it out into a spectrum, into a rainbow. Now, you know a scientist's job. It's to take something beautiful and to turn it into a graph. And that's shown here. This is a plot that shows how much light there is at each wavelength or color. And these absorption lines, as we call them, are caused by the atoms in the atmospheres of the stars in the other galaxy. And they operate by the same microscopic rules of physics as the ones here or in the sun or in the laboratory. So we know that when we see this line, we're seeing the chemical element sodium. It's in the atmosphere of the sun, it's in other stars in our galaxy, and it's also in other galaxies. The interesting thing about the measurements that people were analyzing is that the wavelength is very well known, but the wavelength that you observe for different galaxies can be different depending on whether the galaxy is coming toward you or away from you. If it's coming toward you, there's a shift toward shorter wavelengths, toward the blue. And if the galaxy is moving away from you, these lines are all stretched out to longer wavelengths toward the red. Most galaxies, it turns out, have red shifts. That is, they are moving away from us. Here's what Hubble did with these two sets of measurements. Now you have two sets of measurements. You know what you'll do with that? You'll make a graph. So here it is. Here's distance out this way, measured from the apparent brightness of stars and then from the brightness of galaxies. And here's velocity up this way. These are the ones that are moving away from us faster and faster. There are only a few very nearby galaxies, turns out including M31, so check your homeowner's insurance. There are a few nearby galaxies that are coming toward us, and we'll get here after a while. In general, as you look farther out in the universe, you see things that are moving away from us more rapidly. So it's not only a big universe where the scale of distance is millions of light years, but it's a universe that has this funny property that everything is moving away from you. Now, at the institution where I teach, most of the students and all of the faculty believe that this is the basic picture, that they are at the center, and that the galaxies somehow know about this and are moving away from us. This we call the egocentric universe. That could be true, but if we've learned anything from the history of science, it's that assuming that we're at the center of things has been a very bad bet. Assuming that the Earth was at the center of the solar system, bad bet. Assuming that the Sun is at the center of our galaxy, well, I pointed out where Santa Barbara is, we're out in the outskirts, a spiral arm of our own Milky Way galaxy. And it would be almost willful stupidity to think that we must somehow be at the center of the universe. So you might ask yourself, well, okay, but how can you see everything moving away from you without being at the center? And I thought I'd take a few seconds to try to show you that. So here's the idea. This is a picture of some field of galaxies, and all I've done is stretch it out in all directions, just magnify it a little bit. And what you can see is if you were living on that galaxy, it would look to you like everybody is moving away from you. And in fact, the nearby ones move a small distance in the same time that the more distant ones move a big distance. You would see something that just like Hubble's law if the universe were just stretching out in all directions. Well, you might say, well, that proves that galaxy is the center of the universe. Now pay attention, here we go. Not so, he says. Suppose we picked another galaxy. Let's go over to this one. All right, and now this is the same set of pictures, okay, just stretched out in all directions. They're lined up there, so it'll look good. But it's the same set of pictures. And the same set of pictures produces that impression for the an observer, an astronomer, someone named Hubble, I suppose, on this galaxy. So no matter which galaxy you pick, if the universe is the same in all directions, then it doesn't matter whether you're on one galaxy or another. If the whole universe is stretching out, every observer will see something like Hubble's law. Okay, so now we're up to 1931. We better hurry up. Here are some of the principles in the case. The fellow with the chalk doesn't even need a union card. It's Albert Einstein, of course. This is George Ellery Hale, who built the Mount Wilson telescopes and also the Palomar telescope. And the person he is patting on the head is Edwin Hubble. And there's seven people here in front of a large number of books. At this point, Einstein, whom you will recall, had gone to a lot of trouble to make a static universe and put this cosmological constant in to do it, was visiting the observatory at Mount Wilson. This is the headquarters on Santa Barbara Street, how appropriate, in Pasadena, and was learning, talking to the people about what the observation showed about the expanding universe. The legend is that at this point he smote himself on the forehead and said, what a stupid idea that cosmological constant is. But it turned out it's more sophisticated than that. Einstein actually is shown here on his visit to Santa Barbara, and through the same technical means that I showed you earlier, we're actually able to see what he's thinking. He was thinking this lambda, this Greek letter lambda, is the one that stands in for the cosmological constant. And it was, Einstein certainly was thinking about whether you needed to have this or not, and it looked like the universe was expanding, not static, so did you need it at all? This became a legend when George Gamow wrote his own autobiography. In his own autobiography, he says, Einstein's original gravity equation was correct, that is, before he put in the cosmological constant, and changing it was a mistake. Much later, when I was discussing cosmological problems with Einstein, I wrote a book, and I wish I could have put that in there. Anyway, much later, when I was discussing cosmological problems with Einstein, he remarked that the introduction of the cosmological term was the biggest blunder he ever made in his life. But this blunder rejected by Einstein, is still sometimes used by cosmologists even today. And the cosmological constant, denoted by the Greek letter lambda, rears its ugly head again and again and again. I believe that's why we call it Einstein's greatest blunder. But it turns out, at the time, astronomers were thinking, well, maybe it wasn't so crazy. Here is the Greek letter lambda, this is lowercase lambda, where Willem de Sitter, a very distinguished astronomer at Leiden, is shown explaining how the presence of this cosmological constant is the thing that makes the universe expand. English is a dialect of Frisian, and so you can read this. It says, who, however, blows up the ball up. What makes the universe expand or swell up, upzwelt? That must be the lambda. Any other answer cannot be given. So it's not true that as soon as people saw that the universe was expanding that they gave up on the cosmological constant. There were at least some people who thought that maybe that was the reason why the universe was expanding. And what I'll say at the end is that we've come back to that view, that here we are 70 years later talking about this cosmological constant or something very like it making the universe expand, being the thing that makes it go. What was Einstein's own view? Well, you can go to the National Academy and you can check up on Einstein. They have a nice statue of him there. It shows him with no socks, so it must be true. There are, on this tablet brought down from a nearby mountain, there are three equations. There's E equals mc squared. That's in the Bartlett's book of familiar quotations. There's the one about the photoelectric effect, and then there's a basic equation for general relativity in here. But there's no lambda. There's no lambda in that version. What he actually said was much more sensible than this was my greatest blunder. What he actually said was an increase in the precision of data will enable us in the future to fix its sign and determine its value. And the point of tonight's talk is, this is the future. Well, you knew that, but that this is the future he was talking about, that 75 years later we have instruments sharp enough and tools powerful enough to be able to actually make this measurement and to see that we really need something like it. Okay, I was very interested to see that this has penetrated the consciousness of people here in Santa Barbara. Here it says, Albert Einstein first proposed the idea of a cosmological constant as part of his general theory of relativity. This is describing a Pinot Noir. Physicists today continue to denote this, now modified concept, with the Greek symbol lambda. Then it goes on to describe the winery and so on. Well, that just goes to show this is the right place to talk about this subject. Okay, here's a picture of Einstein, and here is de Sitter. In what the theorists call de Sitter's space. And they are looking at a Hubble diagram, a diagram of velocity and distance, the same sort of thing that I talked about before. And Einstein is pointing out to de Sitter how you would know whether the universe was speeding up or slowing down. And the way you would do it is by using this fact that I talked about before, that time and distance are interchangeable. By looking at the most distant objects, you see the universe as it was when the light was emitted from them. And if the universe has been slowing down during the time while the light's in travel, the distance that it has to travel is a little smaller than it would be if the universe speeds up during the time while the light is traveling to you. The distances that we need to study are bigger than the one shown here. Here's the relation between velocity and distance. It's just a straight line. That means that the universe is just expanding without much acceleration over the small span of distance and time shown in this diagram. The idea is you should make a much bigger diagram, go much farther away in order to see the effect. This diagram only goes out to 2 billion light years, a mere 2 billion light years, and the Hubble law seems a very good representation of the data. I'll explain what the data are in a minute, over that range. But if you go to 4, 6, 8 billion years into the past, you actually are then looking about halfway back to the Big Bang, and you have a chance to see the effect of cosmic speeding up or slowing down. Okay, well, Hubble was right on the money. He said, how are we going to do this? He noticed that there were a mysterious class of exceptional novae, these new stars, which for a little while are as bright as a large fraction, or as nearly as bright as the whole galaxy in which they're embedded. And these are the clue, these are the tool that we've been using to measure distances over these very large distances. These are the exploding stars, the supernovae. Here's a picture of Fritz Zwicky using the camera, the first telescope built at Palomar, a little Schmidt telescope, which was used to search for supernovae. So Fritz put a lot of effort into finding these things in the 1930s and trying to understand what they were and trying to use them for cosmic distances. We know what they are now. They're exploding stars. They're about 4 billion times as bright as the Sun. They are a million times brighter than the stars that Henrietta Leavitt was studying. They're pretty rare. You haven't seen one in our galaxy, even though obviously this is the audience of people who would be paying attention. There's about one per century in a galaxy. But there are 10 to the 11th galaxies in the universe, and it's left as an exercise to the student to show that that means there's one per second in the universe. So if you're just diligent and figure out how to search well enough, you should be able to find lots of these supernovae, to find out what they are, and then use them for cosmic distances. Fritz Zwicky had some ideas about what supernovae might be, and here he published it in a reputable journal, the Los Angeles Times, actually, in January of 1934. In this cartoon, Be Scientific with Old Doc Dabble, it says, cosmic rays are caused by exploding stars, which burn with a fire equal to 100 million suns. Well, okay, I said 4 billion. And then shrivel from half million mile diameters to little spheres, 14 miles. He's talking about the collapse of a massive star to become a neutron star. And we think that some supernovae are the result of that kind of collapse. But it turns out, as a little bit of a surprise, there are two. Nature has two kinds of supernovae. One that is the massive star that has a core collapse, and the other that is really a bomb in which the leftover fuel from nuclear burning burns suddenly as a thermonuclear explosion as the type 1 supernovae. And it turns out that those stars, which are the ones we've been discussing at our meeting here over the last several months, are the ones that are the best candidates for this kind of work. So just to give you a feeling for supernovae, here there have been some relatively nearby and not too long ago where we can see what's going on. This is the famous supernova of 1987, which was in the Large Magellanic Cloud, seen from the southern hemisphere. This is a space telescope view. And this is the shredded star. This is the actual stuff flying out from it. Going back a little farther and into our own galaxy, here's the supernova from about 400 years ago that was seen by Tycho in November of 1572. And when you look there now, you see this expanding thing, which is the leftover, the remnant of a supernova explosion. This one, we think, is of the type that we're talking about when we look at these distant supernovae to measure distances. Okay. Now, the supernovae are extremely interesting because they are bright and they allow us to measure the universe. They're also extremely interesting because they make the heavy elements. There are nuclear reactions that take place in the explosion itself that synthesize the heavy elements out of light ones. So this car, for example, which is made of a lot of Detroit iron, those iron nuclei were actually made in supernova explosions that took place before the sun was formed. Well, here are seven people in front of a lot of books. We don't have a picture of Hale yet. But anyway, this is our my gang at the Center for Astrophysics, who are working on these problems. And I wanted to say a little bit about what we've been doing and the way in which these supernova measurements of these supernova tell us that the universe is speeding up. So we have some telescopes out in Arizona. And one of the things you can do is to measure the getting bright and getting dim of supernovae. So here it is. This is what we call the light curve. I said that the supernova is bright for about a month. And if you look down here, here's 20 days, 40 days. So the supernova is bright for about a month. And it turns out that there is also a clue in this light curve to the intrinsic brightness of the supernova. Some are a little brighter, some are a little dimmer, like 200 watt bulbs, 100 watt bulbs, and 50 watt bulbs. And it turns out, just by coincidence, that the brightest supernovae have the slowest declines. These are the same words that Henrietta Leavitt used for the Cepheids, just turns out, for different reasons, that the supernovae also have that property, that the rate at which the supernova declines after maximum light is different in different cases, and it allows us to tell which are the extra bright and which are the extra dim ones. When you do that, that's when you get this kind of Hubble diagram that I had before with Einstein superposed on it. These are the supernova measurements. So for each supernova, we measure a distance from its apparent brightness and the redshift, and that's what's plotted here. Hubble's original Hubble diagram fit in that little square down there, red square as we call it. Kremlin is on this side. So he had the right idea, but he was using a tool that didn't extend as far out as the ones that we've got now. So you can see that we see a very good relation here, and the idea was to extend that out to higher, bigger distances to try to find out whether the universe was expanding, was speeding up or slowing down. We certainly expected to see slowing down due to gravity, because we know there's gravity in the universe, and it is an attractive force and should be pulling on things. How much? Well, the language we use is, of course, to use spooky Greek letters. And here's the spookiest of the Greek letters, the last letter of the Greek alphabet, omega. And omega measures the density of matter, or whatever it is you're talking about, compared to a particular density called the critical density, which is the one that is just the right density to make the geometry of the universe the geometry of Euclidean space, the thing that you learned in high school. Parallel lines don't meet. Circles have a circumference that's 2 pi r and all that stuff. This is how we measure it, by talking about this number, omega. And it turns out our clue to this comes again from Fritz Zwicky, shown here at a somewhat later stage of life. There's Fritz Zwicky, and he noticed that if you look at bunches of galaxies as they swarm around, they move quite fast compared to what you'd expect if all the mass were associated with the stars in the galaxy. And from that measurement of the speed at which galaxies move in clusters, he inferred that there must be a lot more mass that was not in the stars, that was not luminous, that was dark, which he called dark matter. And it turns out that in the places where galaxies are, that there's a lot more of this dark matter than of the visible matter that's in the stars, which was quite a big surprise. Took a long time for people to accept that. But even so, the dark matter is only about an omega of 0.3, about 3/10 of the amount of matter that's needed to make the universe geometrically flat. This is a cluster of galaxies. And you can see another effect of gravity at work here. The presence of matter in the universe also curves the local space. And you can see that there is imaging of objects behind that are these funny arcs that are caused by the mass in the cluster bending the light from something behind. By measuring the properties of these rings, these arcs, you can also get a measure for the value of omega, and it's about 0.3. Okay. So that's what we expected, to be able to see the presence of that attracting matter slowing things down when we look deep in the past. Here are the tools we've been using. The 4-meter telescope at Cerro Tololo in Chile. This is a picture taken with an electronic camera, a digital camera, at night. This is not a fake. This is what the plane of the Milky Way galaxy really looks like from Cerro Tololo. Here's the Magellanic Cloud. And, it's a wonderful place. And in that telescope, as in other telescopes around the world, they're very large detectors, very large digital cameras. You can go down to Best Buy and you can get yourself an 8-megapixel digital camera if you're willing to shell out the big bucks. This is a 186-megapixel camera, very good for taking pictures at birthday parties and so on, except for the fact that you have to keep it at a temperature of liquid nitrogen. That's kind of awkward. But it is a very sensitive, very big light detector. And with cameras like this, the one we're using is in Chile on the 4-meter telescope. There are similar cameras on the 4-meter telescope at the Canada-France-Hawaii telescope, where there's another big program going on. When you take an image, you get on it many, many, many galaxies. All these little dots in the background are also galaxies where we can actually detect the presence of supernovae. If there's a supernova every 100 years, that's about a supernova every 5,000 weeks. So if you have 5,000 galaxies, your chances of finding a nice fresh supernova are pretty good. And a picture like this has in it several thousand galaxies. We can take many pictures like that through the night. And we can do it. Other teams can do it. We can find many supernova in a single night. Now, when we got going on this in 1994, there was already another team working, the Sol Perlmutter's group at the Lawrence Berkeley lab. And Brian Schmidt, who was then just finishing up as my student, wanted to work on a project as a postdoc. And he said, well, you know, we could do that. And I said, well, you know, that team has been working on the software for 5 years. And he said, well, I could do it in a month. Well, he sort of did do it in a month, although the software was very unreliable for quite a long time. And we were able to use these images with the power of computers to find new objects. So here's the idea. You take a picture. So this is about 1/1000th of the image area of one of those big pictures. And you have some picture from last month. Remember, the supernova takes several weeks to get bright and get dim. So you take an old picture, subtract it from a new picture, and everything that is the same, like this big fuzzy spiral galaxy, subtracts away. The only things that show up in this difference image would be something that's new in the second image, this dot up here, which you can barely make out, but which shows up fine when you do the subtraction. Not only that, it has a red circle around it, so you won't miss it. This is the ultimate of unskilled and inexpensive labor of the type that Pickering was talking about, that is to use computers to do this. But of course, once again, it has to be done under careful supervision, and that is provided by the graduate students and postdocs in our group. Here's the results from our group. There are similar work from the Canada-France-Hawaii telescope, the Supernova Legacy Survey. And what's shown is the supernovae nearby, like the ones I showed you before, and then supernovae very far away, about halfway back to the Big Bang, roughly speaking, third to half of the way back to the Big Bang. And what you're supposed to notice is that this dashed line, which is one where the universe is slowing down due to the presence of dark matter, is not a good fit to the data. Now, you know, take a moment here. This took us 4 years, so. But you can see that the points up here don't lie on this line. They don't even lie on this blue horizontal line, which is the one that you would get if the universe was slowing down due to an omega of about 0.3, the omega due to the dark matter that we know is present. You can see that most of the points lie up this way, and up that way is that they are a little too faint for their distance, as if the universe had expanded a little extra during the time when the universe, while the light was in flight. This was big news in 1998. It was big news to Einstein, who had, of course, been dead for decades. But he now is carrying around something that has lambda on it. I don't know if you can read this top sheet. So this is kind of a revisionist image of Einstein, surprised at seeing the universe expand faster and faster. And there are two groups that came out with results, ours in 98 and theirs in 99. In addition, there are measurements of the glow of the Big Bang itself, the cosmic microwave background, which tell us what the geometry of the universe is. These freckles in this glow of the baby big, these freckles on the, calm down, these freckles on the baby, infant Big Bang, that's what I wanted to say. The properties of these fluctuations actually tell us quite directly what the geometry of the universe is, and they point out that we live in a universe that is flat, that has omega, the total omega, very, very close to one. So I said that the omega due to matter, the dark matter, was about 0.3. This shows us that the total omega is about one, and the supernova observations show us that there's something else in the universe that has energy density that is making things speed up. And that could be the cosmological constant or something very like it. So here's the idea of the geometry omega equals 1 is one where the geometry is the kind of geometry you're used to. If the density, the total omega is bigger or smaller, the curvature of the whole universe would have different properties and affect how we see those freckles on the Big Bang. When you put this together, this is what you get. And this is really quite astonishing. A universe in which atoms, like the stuff you and I are made out of, or even that big car, only make up about 4% of the total energy density in the universe. The dark matter, and especially the dark matter that is not atoms, there's a whole story about how that happens. If the dark matter were made of regular neutrons and protons, it would spoil the cooking of the elements in the Big Bang. So we're quite sure that most of this gravitating stuff is not neutrons and protons, it's something else, maybe weakly interacting stuff. And that most of the universe at the present time has to be made up of this weird dark energy. Now, this is the point to say that theorists are very proud of this. Theorists are very proud of this diagram up here. And they say, look, it is full. And I only caution those of you in the audience to ask the next question. What is it full of? And the answer is, it is full of ignorance. It is full of ignorance, our most important resource. It means that there is a lot to be done. We don't know what the cold dark matter is, though people are looking for it. And we really don't know what the dark energy is. It could be the cosmological constant or something like it, but it might be something that changes over time, or it might be something that's caused by a misunderstanding about exactly how gravity works or whether there are extra dimensions in the universe. So we're really interested in that. And it means that the things that we know and love make up only a very small fraction of the universe, and that there's this titanic battle going on, a kind of tug of war between gravity trying to slow things down and the dark energy trying to speed things up that has very little to do with us. Now, you might say, this doesn't sound very sensible, and it certainly doesn't. I found that when we went to, on a trip, I went to the Weizmann Institute to the gift shop, and they were selling t-shirts with funny sayings by clever people, like Einstein saying, you know, God does not play dice with the universe, and Will Rogers, and then there's a quote from me. It said, although the universe is under no obligation to make sense, students in pursuit of the PhD are. We could edit that to make it a little punchier. But anyway, they were selling these t-shirts. I was very astonished to find them. And I was able to get some at a good discount. Okay. So this dark energy is real, but what is it? Here's a kind of complicated looking diagram. The supernovae tell us something about the mix of dark energy and dark matter. This microwave background tells us something about the sum of the two. It turns out the way galaxies are clustered tells us about omega matter, how much stuff there is in the universe. And they all intersect at this one area, the thing that was represented by that pie chart I showed you before. What is the dark energy? Well, I did what anybody would do. I Googled it. And you get the site of American Hydroponics, which is an organization that makes plant food for growing controlled substances in your closet. And as part of the advertising copy, it says, these specialized processes are also responsible for the very distinct odor of dark energy. And among theorists, dark energy does have a kind of an odor, kind of a bad odor. First of all, it's this legacy of Einstein. Einstein, you know, said, oh, this is a bad idea, don't work on it. You know, maybe someday in the far future it'll be worth talking about. But you really have to talk about it now. And sorry, David, but I would skip over this, except it's so delicious, that this is my old union card with my old picture. And I, you know, for the audiences I travel in, I have to actually point out. You know, anyway, this is my old one. And you know how physicians and surgeons, airline pilots have to be recertified every once in a while. And so I was ready to give myself this card, but in case you hadn't thought of it, but you were way ahead of me, as always. Okay, so what's the theoretical issue? The theoretical issue is, Is the dark energy the cosmological constant, or is it something else? If you ask somebody who knows about these things, what would you estimate for the energy associated with gravity? They would say, well, there's the Planck scale, and you ought to take that, the energy density, you ought to go like the fourth power, and you'd get some big number. This big number, this is the back of the envelope calculation. This is actually an envelope. And you get a number where the observed value is about 0.7. You get here a value of about 10 to the 120. That's a 1 with 120 zeros. I don't have room to write this out. This is what we call not good quantitative agreement. Or what Steven Weinberg called a bone in the throat of physics. It points to something really important, which is this thing that we've discovered by observation is telling us there really is a cosmological something, might be the cosmological constant, but it's very much smaller in energy density than you would guess or estimate from the most basic physical considerations. And the idea, of course, is go back, and I did this until the park police came, is to put the cosmological constant, something like it, on the right-hand side of Einstein's equations. Whoops. Okay, now let me just finish up by saying a word about measuring really distant supernovae and seeing whether this story's really right. If there is a mixture of dark energy and dark matter, it's a tug of war going on, where dark matter is trying to slow things down, dark energy is trying to speed things up. If you think what the universe was like when it was half its current age, that balance would have been different. Because the universe, any chunk of the universe, would have been half as big, roughly speaking, half as big in each dimension, so it would have 1/8 the volume. So the density of matter would have been higher by a factor of 8 if you go back to the time when the universe was half its current size. And that means that the energy density of matter, the slowing down stuff, would have been bigger. So what you expect, if there really is a mixture of dark matter and dark energy and this kind of tug of war going on over time, if you go into the distant past, you would expect that the dark matter had the upper hand and the universe should have been decelerating in its distant past before it was accelerating. So this is interesting because it's a prediction of this kind of model, and it turns out that the Hubble Space Telescope, named after Edwin Hubble, with the same size mirror as the telescope at Mount Wilson, but at a much better site, is able to actually see supernovae from this era. And we've actually been able to make this measurement. Last time astronauts went up to the Space Telescope in 2002, they brought a new camera, which they had purchased at Ball Brothers for $86 million. Certainly worth every penny, was attached to the telescope by the astronauts. And we used that to search for distant supernovae. That camera was big enough that you could actually use the space telescope to go back to the same field several times and find supernovae. So here's a series of images on the left side, and what you all want, a graph on the right side, that shows the measurements of this supernova. So here's the supernova, getting brighter, and then getting dimmer over time. This is a very distant supernova, too faint to see from the ground, too far away, too far back. But by measuring the light curve and the slope of the curve, and by measuring the redshift of the supernova or the little fuzzy galaxy in which it's located, you can actually find out whether this lies on the prediction or above it or below it. And the answer is that it shows there really was deceleration, that the universe, we think, began at some early time with very rapid expansion in the inflationary era. And then it was slowing down due to the action of dark matter. The big surprise is that there's now acceleration today, but we've actually seen the signature of this slowing down. Every physicist knows that the change in position is motion, is velocity, change in velocity is acceleration, and change in acceleration is jerk. And that is why it is funny that to talk about the cosmic jerk, it is not quite so funny to have your picture under a cosmic jerk in the New York Times. But this is Adam Riess, who was my graduate student and has been leading this work with the Hubble Space Telescope, showing that the universe was slowing down and then it has changed to speeding up about 5 billion years ago. And although there are many questions to ask about the supernovae as distance measuring tools, I think this is quite convincing that we're really on the right track, that the effect changed sign and we really can see it. Okay, well, there's the data, never mind. Okay, what about, what's next for space telescope? We hope that camera is now broken. And so we have been unable to go much beyond where we were last year with the observations. We hope that there will be a servicing mission in the year 2008 when there will be a new camera and a new spectrograph brought up to the space telescope, and that we'll be able to continue this pursuit for the next several years. Beyond that, many people are dreaming of building a specialized telescope that would be just for the purpose of studying the supernovae, and one manifestation of this is the thing we proudly call DESTINY, the Dark Energy Space Telescope. Pretty good acronym. The design is less sophisticated than that, but in any case, we're working on that. And of course, there is the hope that large telescopes on the ground will be built that will have the ability to measure these very distant supernovae, especially in the infrared. So one idea for how to do that is this one, what we call the Giant Magellan Telescope. This is made up of seven telescope mirrors, each of which is 8 meters across. Actually, what we really do is we keep using the same model and we keep getting smaller people to put in the picture. This is one of the telescopes that we hope and dream of and expect to build in the coming decade or so. Okay, and the first mirror for that has already been cast. These are full-size people. Okay, yeah, it's 8 meters. A meter. Okay. So this dark energy, it certainly is a sign that we don't know how to combine gravity and quantum mechanics. That's the theorist idea. It could be that there are modifications to general relativity that are important. It could be a clue that we're seeing the effect of extra dimensions. We don't know. If you're interested in these matters, I cannot recommend a better book than this one, available now in 5 languages. Okay. So this has been a long story. You've been a very good audience, paying close attention to every nuance. I thought it would be good to just finish up by saying something more general about the kind of science that this investigation is. I was the president of the American Astronomical Society for a number of years. It's just finishing up. And often, when you're in that sort of position, you're asked to say to people, why is it that you are doing this? Why should we go forward? And so I was with presidents of other organizations like the Chemical Society and the Physical Society. And their arguments usually sound like this. Well, science is very important to the advance of technology, which it certainly is, no question about it. That's a good thing in itself because it makes the economy grow. People often talk about the contribution to national defense. And because a lot of congressmen are kind of old guys, medicine is a surefire argument for doing scientific work. And I want to be clear, I am in favor of all these things. I think it's good to be rich and safe and, well, long-lived anyway. But this kind of work is really about something else. I think people really want to know, where did we come from, what's going on, and where are we headed? And that people are really curious about the nature of the universe. So this is not enough to be rich, safe, immortal, and bored, it seems to me. Would not be a good thing that people really want to know, and that this kind of science that I've described tonight is really science for the joy of finding out how the world works. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob. I think you live up to everybody's expectations. And now I'm going to open the floor to the extremely good questions that we usually have. And Bob, I'm sure, willing to answer them. We'll go on for maybe till 9:30 or so, I imagine, with this number of people. And then there will be refreshments in the common room, which is right down the hall to which you're all invited. So we have... Please, you know, I'll bring the microphone. Why don't you take the microphone? Find people there, and I'll do the same on this side. Talk into the microphone.
All right, but I'm holding on to the pointer.
Okay. Supernova in the deceleration phase, were they on the Hubble plot you showed, or are they?
Yeah, I skipped over the last little bit there because I was running out of time. Well, let me go back and I'll show you that. This is the actual diagram. It's a little bit different plot, but it's the one that shows that the supernovae are a little faint. And then as you go farther back, the sign changes, and they're actually a little bright. So it's that bending down of these outermost points that is the evidence that we really have seen back to the time of deceleration. So that's the data.
Supernova?
No, there are six.
There's six there.
There's six in here. We made the product of the redshift and the number of supernovae, six. That's how we bend it up. I have no idea why.
Yes, I had a question I've been thinking about for a long time about the expansion of the universe.
Yeah.
If something 7 billion light years ago seems to be traveling faster than something 2 billion light years away, I keep considering that 7 billion years ago things were moving faster than they are now. So maybe they've slowed down in the past 7 billion years.
Yeah, so the picture is this stretching out in all directions. So suppose by the with the cooperation of the friends of the KITP, we could suddenly make this room twice as big. What would you see? Well, you'd see the people who are one seat away would end up two seats away, and the people who are five seats away would end up 10 seats away. So the nearby ones would be moving away from you slowly, and the more distant ones moving away from you more rapidly. Now, you're asking the next level of question. Over time, how has the expansion been going, and how would it look to each of the observers? And the answer is, it depends. It depends on this balance between gravitation slowing things down and the dark energy speeding things up. If the universe were just coasting at a constant speed, then 7 billion years in the past, the expansion would have been comparable to the expansion today. But depending on the balance between dark energy speeding things up over time and dark matter slowing things down over time, that can have different forms. So your question, which was meant to be a simple one, opens up this more complicated story of how the expansion has changed over time. The simple thing about how it would look to different observers at the same epoch is that at any particular time, the expansion rate would be the same in different parts of the universe.
But 7 billion years ago, things were going faster because the redshift is bigger at something 7 billion years ago.
Well, the expansion could be going at a constant rate, or it could be slowing down, or it could be speeding up. So you actually have to look at it more carefully. But your question of whether another observer would see the same thing at the same time, the answer is yes. But you're right that when you're looking at a distant observer, their time is not, you know, the same as when they look at their watch. They're seeing the light, the time when the light was emitted, which was a long time ago, and you're looking at your calendar, and you see a time that's much longer after the Big Bang, and there may have been a change in the history, in the expansion rate over time. So I hope that was helpful.
But maybe another way to say it is that 7 billion years ago, the universe would have been smaller, but still expanding at the same rate.
It was expanding faster.
Yes, expanding faster.
Expanding at the same rate.
Yeah, but I mean, he's asking the question: if it changes over time, wouldn't the distant object reflect that?
And the answer is even if there was no cosmological constant.
Yeah. Don't get us arguing between ourselves. Or, you know, this is the trick of the PhD oral. I know this. Let's get the professors discussing with each other.
Your calculations depend on measuring the light intensity. How do you know that there isn't something in the way? I mean,
yes.
Dust or something affected the transmission of light that a dielectric or whatever?
Exactly right. So one of the puzzles, since we're depending on measuring the distance by the apparent brightness, you could get into trouble, for example, if there were a cloud of dust between you and the source. How would that affect it? Well, it could absorb some or scatter some of the light, and as a result, you would think that the object was farther away than it really was. And that would be a bad thing. It would mess these things up. Turns out, we thought about this quite hard and have used the nearby samples of supernovae to figure out, first of all, what the colors of the supernovae are when there's no dust. That's good to know. And then we measure the colors of the supernovae as we see them. If there's dust, it leaves a signature on the color. That's the interesting point. It absorbs the blue light more than it absorbs the red light. So what we look for, the signature that we look for, is a change in the color, which would be attributable to the action of this dust. And then we say, oh, that's the action of dust. And we know how much dimming you get for how much color change and make a correction for that. That is probably the weakest link in this whole thing. So you've put your finger exactly on our weakest point, which is really knowing the colors of the supernovae, really knowing how the dust works, and being certain that the distant supernovae are really behaving in the same way as the nearby ones. Because if they had slightly different colors and we attributed that to dust, we'd be very rapidly on a path to making a mess of this. Nature has been quite kind to us. The supernovae seem to be very similar at high redshift as the nearby ones. Not necessarily identical, but our methods for making these corrections seem to work okay. But this is the kind of thing that keeps astronomers up at night, so to speak. Yeah, is that right? Put this finger right on it.
Since type 1A supernovae become more elusive, the more distant, or that is, the older they are, why not try to use another object, something more exotic, to go into the primordial universe, say quasars?
Yeah. Well, the way we try to measure the distance is by the apparent brightness. And the wonderful thing about these type 1A supernovae is that the range of intrinsic brightness is pretty small. And even the ones that are the brightest are maybe 3 or 4 times as bright as the ones that are the dimmest. And we correct for that by this light curve shape business that I described briefly. The quasars have a much bigger range of intrinsic brightness, and they are much more variable. So there's no standard candle that we know of, no standard brightness for the quasars that allows us to make the kind of measurement you're talking about. It would be fantastic if we could, because the quasars, which are giant black holes at the centers of galaxies, are exceedingly bright, much brighter than the supernovae. And we can see them out to redshift 2 and 3, as you were saying. But they have a very big range in brightness, and so they don't work well as standard candles, the kind of tool that we've been using the supernovae, the kind of job we've been using the supernovae to do.
Why do the type 1A supernova have the ones that are brighter have a slower decay in brightness?
Yeah. Well, now you can come to the conference and, you know, hang out with the experts, because that's the kind of question people have been talking about. What people say is there's a range in when the explosion takes place. These are in stars which are very nearly of the same mass. We think there's an upper mass limit to white dwarfs, and we think these are white dwarf stars when they explode. So they have carbon and oxygen, and it burns in a thermonuclear flame up to make iron and nickel. And that nickel is radioactive, and that powers the light curve. So that's already kind of a complicated story, but it looks as though some supernovae make more nickel than others. And when they do, some are brighter than others. The decline rate depends on how good a blanket the atmosphere of the exploding star is at kind of keeping the heat in. And it looks like the ones that have the higher luminosity stay warm longer, and that makes them opaque longer, so that the peak takes longer. So it's a longer time over the peak. So roughly speaking, that seems to be more or less right. But it turns out, when you get a lot of real experts in the room, some other people have slightly different ideas, and there's a real discussion about exactly what's going on. There's also a possibility that you might be able to measure at different wavelengths and see different behavior from the supernovae. I don't know if you noticed, but when I showed you that first set of light curves, there were a lot of different colors of those graphs. And at different wavelengths, which are represented by those different colors, the shape of the light curve is different. And it might be that by choosing exactly the right color, we could get around that effect or make that effect smaller or do a better job of measuring the distances to the supernovae. And especially if we go into the infrared, it looks like the supernovae behave even better. So that's what we're exploring. We're trying to learn about that. So the reason why is that the atmosphere stays warm, but we're trying to think how to do a better job of getting the distance right and doing a more precise job of finding what the history of the cosmic expansion has been.
I have a question about the dark matter. Is it generally concentrated around galaxies? And in contrast, is dark energy assumed to be uniformly distributed throughout?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. So the question is whether the dark matter is clumped like the galaxies are. And we think the short answer is yes, that the mix of dark matter and luminous matter more or less the same. So when you see that the things that you see trace the presence of the mass. And one of the ways that we know that that's true is from this gravitational lensing, the lensing effect of the matter, so that even when you don't see even if you didn't count up the galaxies all that well, you would see the effect of the dark matter. And generally speaking, the dark matter is in the places where the luminous matter is too. So that's quite fortunate for us, because that means that our measurements of the galaxies give us an indication of this much bigger chunk of the universe that is the dark matter. It's a little like looking at a ridge of mountains in the moonlight, you know, and you see where the snow is up there. And the snow is not the mass of the mountains. It's the thing you see. But it does show you more or less reliably where the bulk of the stuff is. So that's the dark matter, which we think is distributed more or less around the luminous things. The dark energy we think is smooth. And of course, that's just a first approximation. If it really is the cosmological constant, then it would be smooth. But you know, we don't know very much about the distribution of the dark energy. But the simplest answer is that the dark matter would be clumped and the dark energy smooth.
I understand that there's a reasonably disfavored theory of this modified Newtonian dynamics with your recently refreshed theorist card. Would you care to comment on that?
Yeah, this modified model works quite well for the properties of individual galaxies, and the rotation curves of galaxies can be explained pretty well by saying instead of having dark matter, you have a little change in the inverse square law. That when you get to a certain kind of acceleration, very small acceleration that you can't test in the lab, so there's no way to prove it's wrong, that the law of gravity changes a little bit. What's been much more difficult is to construct a picture like Einstein's that can be applied to the whole universe and to actually make predictions about the whole universe. But people are making progress on that theoretical aspect also. That means there's the chance to test those ideas against the cosmology. And I think that that's going to be sort of, that will finally put the nail in the coffin. I mean, that will, I believe. I don't care. We'll learn more about the nature of gravity from these cosmological measurements on a big scale. So the MOND is successful on the scale of individual galaxies, less successful on the scale of galaxy clusters, where there's some interesting cases where it looks like it doesn't work properly.
Or mergers.
Yeah. But, you know, it's still a kind of worthy opponent in a way. I think on the big cosmological scale is where it doesn't really seem to have as much grip. and we will see whether modifications to gravity are or are not acceptable given the supernova data. The plot that I showed a little while ago, it's still there. No, yeah, this one actually shows not Mond, but it shows some other things where gravity is modified. Are these lines down here, which really have a hard time fitting the data. So it's very early days in all of this. It's very hard to rule out models. The data are not really all that strong, but it looks like all the measurements we've made so far are fit with the simplest thing you could think of, which is just a cosmological constant in a flat universe. Now, the fact that you say that, I can say that in that tone of voice, you know, the simplest thing we could have thought of. It turns out people said the same thing in the same tone of voice 20 years ago about a very different model of the universe in which omega matter was one. So you have to be careful of the confident tone of voice.
Besides,
yeah, my question may kind of come from what we were just talking about here, and it has to do with this acceleration. Is it linear in all directions? Is that what we're really talking about? And if so, does that kind of lead back to the concept of this dark energy being fairly uniform?
Yeah, as far as we know, the dark energy is you know, the same in all directions, but this has not been tested very much. The patches of the sky where the supernovae have been found by our group or by the Canada-France-Hawaii telescope group are pretty small fractions of the sky. So that's where we've made the measurement. We make the assumption that that is typical because it's all we've got. As far as we can see, there's no evidence that the expansion is different in one direction, say, than another. But it's something that is probably worth testing, and that if you had a much bigger sample and a more precise sample, that's one of the questions that you would ask. So, you know, it's a very interesting question. It's something where we've made a fairly strong assumption, and it would be good in the future to test whether that assumption's right or not. Yeah. Well. Yes, up to a point. But, you know, I mean, the microwave background's not telling you about that. It's only, you'd have to show that you had redshift in distance over a big chunk of the sky, which people have done out to a certain distance, but it's not very far. And what you see is that the clumps of dark, what you do is you say, oh, it's not completely uniform, and you attribute the differences to clumps of dark matter. Oh, that all fits together, and it's okay, and it's probably right. But there are the question of whether the expansion is really uniform on a big scale, I don't think has been tested very well.
Besides looking out amongst the stars, to what extent can dark energy be measured in the laboratory?
Yeah, that's a really great question, because of course, it would be so much more interesting, and we would know so much more if this were not just the private province of astronomers, but that laboratory physics could actually get to work on it. Now, some aspects of proposals for the explaining what's going on are amenable to test. Things like whether the inverse square law operates over what are the distances over which the inverse square law of gravity operates, and there are some ways to test those in the lab. But generally speaking, we're in this very peculiar situation where what seems to be an extremely important aspect of the physical world is not accessible to laboratory measurement. This is a lot like the situation in the 1600s when astronomers knew from timing eclipses in the solar system that the speed of light was finite, you know, a foot in a nanosecond. Well, they didn't say it that way. But anyway, that the speed of light was finite, and that showed up in astronomical settings. Whereas there was no laboratory measurement of the speed of light. And of course, the constancy of the speed of light, you know, is something that is extremely important in modern physics. So it wasn't until, you know, 1840 or something like that, that people were actually able to make laboratory experiments. I hope that it won't be 250 years until you know, the technology for doing this really gets going. There will be clues from experiments that are ongoing. The LHC, I think, may give us some clue to the properties that are relevant, and we can hope that there will be kind of the development of a picture, a bigger picture of physics, in which we'll somehow understand what we're talking about. But it's a very interesting question. It's something that a lot of people have thought about, and I think it's fair to say there's no simple path that people have thought of for a laboratory experiment to show the presence of this very, very weak, very, very small energy.
Yes, I have a question on the sort of the distribution of dark matter. Does it clump together in things like stars? And then also, if sort of to follow up on that, as I understand that we don't think there are things like nuclear forces in dark matter, and so then what would prevent it from just clumping together down into a point?
Yeah.
Or does it?
Yeah. So there have been, first of all, the picture is that the dark matter has gravitational forces, and people have made huge computer simulations where they start with a universe that just has the dark matter in it, and then tiny, tiny fluctuations that are comparable to the ones that you measure from the microwave background of the Big Bang itself, and you let that go forward, and you calculate what will happen, how the dark matter will clump under the force of gravity. Those calculations have no other force in them, and assume that gravity is the whole story. Now, the actual physical picture for what the particle might be, the most plausible picture for that, I would say, is that they might be weakly interacting particles. So they don't interact by the strong force, the nuclear force, only by the weak force, the same thing that neutrinos interact with matter through. And, you know, neutrinos is kind of a legendary thing. They come out from the center of the sun, they pass through you, they don't care about lead walls and so on, because their interaction with ordinary matter is extremely weak. And so the idea is that it could be that the dark matter particles, whose presence we know because they have gravity, might be some branch of the weakly interacting particle families. That's an area where laboratory experiment really has a good chance of finding these things, because if they're everywhere in the universe or clumped with stuff, then the Earth ought to be moving through a kind of mist of these dark matter particles. And by building the right kind of experiment and shielding out all the other interactions, you might see a kind of ping from the Earth moving through this fog of particles. And there are people who are doing those experiments. I mean, the last time I was in Santa Barbara, I talked to some graduate students right out here. It was a beautiful day, and we were looking out, and there were dolphins playing. And I said, well, what are you working on? They said, oh, we're working on the dark matter experiment. And I said, well, that's good. Where is that? They said, oh, it's in a mine in Minnesota. And they go to the mine in Minnesota, and they lift lead bricks and do the stuff that experimental physicists do down in the basement of the mine, looking for these dark matter particles. So the picture that people have is strong enough to make, you know, to make more or less sane people go from, well, physics graduate students, go from Santa Barbara to northern Minnesota in the winter. People really are, you know, there is a tremendous passion to people doing this work. People really want to find out what the answer is, and they're willing to do things that are inconvenient to themselves to do it.
Generalization on the last question.
Yep.
Are there any other implications relative to quantum physics that you see coming out of this work?
Well, there's a deep mystery here. You know, I was just joking and I showed the back of the envelope and so on. But the real question is a theoretical question. The question is, what is the vacuum? What are the properties of matter or the universe, space, really, space and time, on the smallest scale, which is the place where gravity seems to have its kind of, is the most important thing. And I don't know, maybe David, maybe you'd want to say a word about this. I think that what's really, of course we'll do the observational part and we'll get better knowledge of what the dark energy is. But in terms of really understanding it, I think what's missing is a theoretical idea, a good theoretical idea.
And if we look at the balance between optimism and pessimism,
yes,
would you say it's more important to be concerned about all these wonderful, marvelous distances and numbers that you point out, or should we be more concerned about something trivial like global warming?
Well, I think both things are really, really important. That people, it's important to understand how the physical world works and not to kid ourselves about it. The Earth and the atmosphere are a very complicated system, and you need to have a lot of information about how chemicals in the atmosphere block the transmission or affect the transmission of infrared light and all those things. Turns out, though, science is really not so easy to take apart, and that things that people are doing to do astronomy often turn out to be quite useful for atmospheric physics. The kind of computational stuff that people do to study planets, other planets, turns out to also be useful for our planet. So it's not really either or. Although, of course, there's a kind of emphasis that some people would want to put on one thing more than another. The science is really all of a piece. And by making progress on this kind of question, it's an indirect but not irrelevant way to make progress on some of the other questions. So I think it's important to have some of this science that is done for itself. It's also important to apply science to human, important human issues. And so I think it's not a matter of, if you have one, you could have zero of one and 100% of the other, because I think that would damage our ability to deal with the problems that come up. Because you don't know what those problems are yet. And the larger physical understanding that we develop by doing the fundamental physics and by doing astronomy and so on, turns out does have some effect and some connection to more practical problems. So I think we would be making a mistake to try to turn the faucet completely in one direction, because we'll find out that we needed to know something that that would come from some other direction or some other field of science.
I think we will now thank Bob again for standing up, delivering a wonderful talk.
Good.
And please join us for refreshments.
Thank you. That was a lot of